house, hen house, outhouse, or doghouse in that area.
You'll also hear about new and old films on Blu-ray and on DVD. Plus, you'll hear all the latest Hollywood gossip.
I don't care!
Okay, maybe not the latter, but it is time for Film Sociology with WFYI's film guru.
Kaiser Shizzy!
No, that's Matthew Sosi.
It's such a fine line between stupid and clever, yes.
Let's see how thin the line is. Here's your host, Matthew Sosi.
Hello there, film lovers. Welcome to Film Sociology, a film talk show here on WFYI HD To The Point and WFYI.org. If you have a question or a comment, you can email me at msosi@WFYI.org. Also on Facebook, also on Twitter at Matthew Sosi. The show is available as a podcast. It's also available on iTunes, and we have a blog which you can check out at
filmsociology.tumblr.com.
The voice you just heard is, this will be, year four of the Silver State game?
Oh, yes. The draft is tonight at 6:30. I have...
Draft day.
Yes.
Draft day. No Kevin Costner.
Are you going to be able to draft, or are you auto-picking?
I am auto-picking.
Do you have your players ranked?
No.
Okay, so you're just going to let it do its thing.
Let the chips fall where they may.
All right.
Used it a few times to beat you. Because that's all that's really important is
the Silver Stake. I don't even know. I'll do some research here while we're talking about some things. And
which is so it's normal. So it's business as usual. Kobe looking up other stuff while I'm doing the show. Great.
Figure out what week the Silver State game is, and
because we're just playing for the Silver State.
Yeah. And as anybody knows.
Welcome to the fantasy football portion of Film Sociology.
That's right. Well, it's a big weekend. Football officially kicks off next week. College football this weekend, but
yes,
this is the last weekend, of course, for fantasy football drafts. The Work League, the Big Bird Bowl,
sounds like something at KFC.
Yeah, is tonight at 6:30, and then my family league, the Boom Fantasy Football League, year two.
You're in two leagues.
Is that is Sunday night, so. So we'll see what happens. And as anybody knows that has listened to the show for a long time, that the Silver State game and the Big Bird Bowl Fantasy Football League is the highlight of the Big Bird Bowl season.
Yep.
College football, you have...
The Oaken Bucket.
You have Oaken Bucket. You have USC against Notre Dame. You have...
Actually, we don't acknowledge.
You have Alabama, Auburn.
Let's see, Notre Dame. We have the school code violation. We have the academic violation going up against a liar who sprained both ankles, not rescuing somebody.
Well, he's suspended.
It's the ethical bowl.
The ethics bowl.
The ethics bowl. That's good.
There's Alabama, Auburn. There's Florida, Georgia. Miscellaneous things like that. In baseball, you have Yankees, Red Sox.
There's no bigger rivalry.
There is no bigger rivalry in fantasy football than the Tommy Wiseau All-Stars against Zazu.
Now, for those now asking, why in God's name are
and
you guys talking about this?
I think we're tied. I think we're 2-2.
We? Yes,
yeah.
We are. That is proper use. So this year, crucial. But it's a must win. Every game, this week in particular, the Silver Sticks game will be a must-win. Why are we bringing this up on the film show? I will tell you why. Because the winner, I kind of loaded the deck in my favor, but in this case, not really, as far as the wager. If my team wins, if the Tommy Wiseau All-Stars defeats Zazu, like I'm hoping it will, Kobe has to watch a suspenseful, scary, not too freaky movie of my choice. And I've Psycho was one year.
Yep.
I can't remember the other. So, but if Kobe, if by some miracle Zazu pulls off an upset over the Tommy Wiseau,
we have done, I think, for the last 2 years.
We're the preseason favorite. Kobe will watch a Pam Grier film that he has not viewed yet. So we got to work on the Pam Grier list a little bit before Silver Stakes game.
Mm-hmm.
So we can figure out which films of Ms. Grier's you have not seen.
Yeah.
And your lovely wife. close to 1 year being married. Still doesn't get the whole Pam Grier thing.
Don't get the whole Pam Grier thing.
Wow, we'll have to work on that. Well, did you find the date?
No, I'm working on it.
During the show.
Yep.
Okay.
I told you I would.
All right. New in theaters today.
I told you I'd shoot, but you didn't believe me.
That's right.
Why didn't you believe me?
New in theaters today is we have The Trip to Italy, which has, reunites Steve Coogan and Rob Brydon. Like the first one, and it's apparently more of the second one where they banter and do impressions and eat lots of food, only this time it's in Italy. As Above, So Below, a film that Kobe will not see.
Nope. That's not a chance.
Not from the director of Devil and Quarantine. No, that's a Kobe's shaking his head, a big astounding and resounding no.
That's not what I'm going to see.
Yes. But yeah, that's according to Nouveau, danger lurks in the spooky catacombs beneath the streets of Paris, a found footage style horror film directed by this guy.
Y'all love it, so
I haven't seen it, so I don't know if I don't love it, but they didn't screen it for the press. And I remember we got a lot of emails about apparently at the last minute they added a comma in the title. So we know it's As Above, So Below. Like, stop clubbing, baby seals. One of my favorite memes of all time. Okay, but we're going to start with a documentary called Rich Hill. Not Hank Hill. And you were thinking, no, we've had many seasons of King of the Hill. But it's set in Rich Hill, Missouri, population 1,396. Salute. And it follows three teenage boys. All have their own issues and mountains and challenges. We have a boy that, now this is, it's a little reminiscent as far as, do you remember how much we love the film Medora? That was the small Indiana town.
Yeah, yeah.
And now take away the basketball and you have the teenest of these guys. We have one boy who is, has trouble focusing at school. You can also check out Ed Johnsonat's really nice write-up on the film in Nouveau. But we have the high-strung kid who's going through an angry phase and his skateboard. In fact, there's a great shot of him skateboarding, and he loses his balance, and then you see the skateboard go down a sewer.
Oh.
Yeah, that's not good. But he got it back. He does get it back. But he it almost feels like these guys could go hang out with the greatest freak out ever kid, with Steven. And yeah. if you've never seen The Greatest Freak Out Ever, it is a YouTube series of fiction, but it's an inspired performance of the shirtless, strung kid who just spazzes out over everything. But we have a kid, yeah, and that kid's name's I think it's Apache, if I'm saying right, APPACHEY. Talk about loving parents. And then we have Harley, who the opening scene we see him using Axe body spray. That's strike one. Likes going to gun and knife shops. That's strike two. And even says that he is easy to make mad. And he's supposed to take meds for his anger, and sometimes he does, and sometimes he doesn't. And as the film goes on, he probably has the darkest of the secret. Not really a secret, but something that is revealed that happened to him as a young kid. His mother's in prison, and you're going to find, as you watch the documentary, you find out why. And then we have a young lad who's into football. He's on the football team, not on the book club. And he's very optimistic, but the problem is they keep moving every 6 months. Mm. So it reminds me of Medora. So and I don't mean to dismiss the film, like, because critics do that a lot. You're going to hear me do that with the next film, November Man. It's going to remind you of this, and it's probably not the greatest representation of Missouri, not since there's Bone with Jennifer Lawrence. But it does capture that small town, kind of poor side of town, and what these kids have to go through. It's kind of voyeuristic. You're peeking in. It's unsettling at times, and you hope you actually do hope all three kids turn out all right. Ed Johnsonott's review in Nuvo has a nice thing about it talks about the term Tobacco Road. I would just implore you to go check out Ed's review in Nuvo. I know Chris Lloyd from the Film Yap said he thought it was too short, or you didn't get to spend enough time with these guys. I think you spend enough time with them. But I think it's also one of these where you watch and you've seen these kids. You went to school with these kids. And in some cases, you probably thank goodness that you're not these kids, or that your kids are not these kids. Mm-hmm. But it does peek into a world that we're aware of. And is it going to open in 3,000 screens? No. This was a fan favorite at the Sundance Film Festival, and I can see why. The footage of it is it's impressive, and it's a little startling. So I think it's a good documentary. I don't think it's a great documentary. Ed Johnsonott liked it more than I did, but it does peek into a world that that's a little uncomfortable, and there's nothing wrong with that. I'll take that over Blended, which is out on Blu-ray. Go check that out if you get a chance. You have no response.
Well, I had one loaded good. Here, but you kind of.
So what were
now that was a good movie.
Yeah, it's kind of like, you know, having a nice time at the funeral, a little bit. You know, did you have a good time? You don't really.
Yeah, it was cool.
Yeah, it was fine. Yeah, I know, it's terrible. Also opening in theaters today is The November Man, starring Pierce Brosnan, directed by Roger Donaldson. And looking at the film at first, I wondered if Pierce Brosnan is going to start to take the Liam Neeson path and you know, being an older, distinguished actor and gentleman, and start doing action movies again. Because here's the thing with Brosnan. In this film, he plays a retired CIA agent who is brought in, guess what, Kobe, for one more job.
It always happens.
And guess what? Spy things happen.
Oh, man.
There are twists and turns and double cross and betrayals.
Not spy stuff.
Spies in Europe. In Europe. So
Europe spy stuff.
European spy stuff. Well, he is Irish. But what's intriguing, of course, is now if you're Pierce Brosnan, if you do a film in which you have a gun in your hand, you will forever be compared to James Bond.
Yep.
How is this compared to James Bond? If you are smooth as a character, you will be compared to James Bond. So, you know, I guess playing jerks in comedies, Mrs. Doubtfire, is the only path he has now. That's not entirely true. An example I think of finding a different angle on a character, if a really underrated film called The Tailor of Panama that he did, oh my gosh, probably 15 years ago with Jeffrey Rush and Jamie Lee Curtis, and a young Daniel Radcliffe, pre Harry Potter.
Oh,
but that was he plays an agent, and it's slightly different than the James Bond character. And he also did a film called The Matador with Greg Kinnear, where he's able to do a twist on that. Do we have a trailer or no?
Yeah, we do.
All right, let's. Kobe, you better break this down because it's a Pierce Brosnan action.
Okay,
there might be catchphrases.
Here we go.
Peter Devereaux.
You know what we used to call you? The November Man.
Title.
Because after you pass through, nothing lived.
Catchphrase. Action.
Dropping sound.
You need to look at this.
It's Alice.
She's in trouble. She has information on the agency that they'll kill to keep secret. If you want her to live, you gotta get back in the game.
Radio voiceover guy.
There's a call for you.
Cliche.
Yes. Hello?
Listen to me very carefully. The woman you're with is a killer.
She will find you, and she will kill you.
It's Devereaux. I know he trains.
Things are getting more complicated
her,
now.
Then he's against us.
A lot of things.
Tangled webs.
Do you have a problem with the call?
I do what I'm told to do, sir.
Who are those men with the police?
Damn, so stressed.
They're agents. CIA. Kid is the best
Americans coming in,
trained.
Messing stuff up. Fast.
We're gonna play a little game.
Playful violence.
You bring out the best in me.
Catchphrase.
Clap.
climbing electric sounds leading to an explosion.
Or silence before explosion.
I don't know if he's too in your head, and maybe you're mad because you never had a daddy.
I'll get him.
Tell me about your target.
Male, old, used to have skills.
Condescending.
The best friend I've ever had.
Irony.
Will your friends try to kill you?
Eventually.
Comedic relief.
Slight comedic relief. So there you go. Yeah, cliches abound as far as character and lines. I mean, you put cliches in the trailer, apparently. This does have a couple of things for it. That keeps it from being completely and utterly worthless. It's a few. Brosnan's fine. I like Pierce Brosnan. I like watching him work. There are moments where he, especially in the second half, the first half of the film is just cliche after cliche after cliche. As far as the dialogue and the characters and the plot twists that aren't really, you know, twisty, and the action sequences. But there are moments you get to see Brosnan's character get unhinged. You don't really get to see that from him as an actor, which I kind of liked. There's a nice little footnote because the girl, the woman in this, and she's not a love interest. She's a part of the plot. It's played by Olga Korolenko, who was, of course, the lady in Quantum of Solace. So it's a little Bond alumni thing there. Yes, Linda? Oh, I like it. There are some individual moments. There's a couple action shootouts at the end, and seeing Pierce go a little over the top is kind of entertaining. But it's kind of sadly been there, done that. Not very memorable. So there's that. It's snoozable. Pretty forgetful. It's sad. Okay. We're going to move on because we had to switch the show around a little bit. And my apologies to Richard Propes. We will get him back on the show. Next week, we're supposed to have Mark Dubeck in, and that should be fun. But I do want to get to Dead People We Like because we don't have time for Dead People We Don't Like.
Right.
Sir Richard Attenborough. And it's interesting. I bring this up, and I'm glad you're here, Kobe, of course. I'm glad you're here every week. But he died at the age of 90. Known as a director and an actor. But I'm intrigued, Kobe, when I say Sir Richard Attenborough, first thing that comes to mind.
I don't know him by name. So
you've seen him. That's
yes,
okay.
but when I saw this, I think I saw it on, maybe I saw it online, maybe I saw it on the news, I don't remember what. But
NPR.
The picture I saw, it's the Jurassic Park guy.
Yes, Dr. John Hammond, I believe is his name. Great blues musician, not to be confused with. But yeah, exactly. There was a stretch where, you know, and this is a guy, of course.
It's the grandpa-looking guy from Jurassic Park.
Right. But he also directed, of course, he won Best Director for the Best Picture winner in 1982, Gandhi. He also directed Oh, What a Lovely War, Young Winston, A Bridge Too Far, which had everybody from the Screen Actors Guild on the male side in the 70s. The thriller Magic with Anthony Hopkins, Chorus Line, a musical that a lot of people who love musical theater hate, Cry Freedom with Denzel Washington and Kevin Kline, Chaplin with Robert Downey Jr., that was Downey's first nomination, Shadowlands in Love and War, he worked with Pierce Brosnan in Grey Owl, and Closing the Ring, which I still haven't seen. But yeah, he did some acting in the 40s through the 70s. Of course, he was in The Great Escape. And, but there was that stretch where he was in Jurassic Park. He played Kris Kringle on Miracle on 34th Street.
Oh, yes.
And he had a part as the English ambassador in Hamlet, as well as Elizabeth and many, many others. So that guy. Yeah, that Oscar winner guy. Yeah. So Sir Richard, you know, salute. Hey, I got a great excuse to play a classic interview. Rich Coase, who was a guest on the show, a.k.a. Svengoolie, he is there's the Broadcast Museum up in Chicago is honoring him. And so I think it's a good excuse to play a chat I had with him a little over a year ago. Don't forget, tomorrow night at 10 o'clock, Saturday at 10 on MeTV, Svengoolie will be showing The Mad Ghoul. But here we're going to go back in time and hear my epic chat. Speaking of epic, this is not quite Gandhi epic, but it's darn close. Here is my chat with Rich Coase. you grew up in Chicago, right?
Yeah, I've pretty much spent my whole life here in Chicago, my whole life and even my whole career. I was born in Chicago, and about 4 years after that, we moved to some suburbs of Chicago.
Such as?
Around the Morton Grove Niles area.
As a kid, what horror show host did you watch?
I barely got in on one of the originals. I was very young, but I remember seeing at some relatives' houses when we were there late, Marvin, Terry Bennett, who hosted Chicago's Shock Theater. Now back then, of course, that was the name. Shock was the name of the Universal movie package that was released all over the country.
Mm-hmm.
And that was where Vampyra was first running her stuff out in L.A. And in Chicago, it happened to go to WBKB-TV, where Terry Bennett worked, and he became Marvin, the sort of beatnik-type ghoul host.
That laid the foundation for Jerry G. Bishop?
Not so much, because I think Jerry was already out of town by then and working his way through radio in various cities, radio and TV.
How old were you when you started watching Jerry?
I was actually just about to enter college.
And what were your impressions of watching Jerry work on television?
Well, first of all, I'd been a fan of his anyway from his radio work. He'd been on the air doing morning radio and such for many years already before he even hit that. And I was a fan of his, so I was tuning in just because I heard that he was doing some funny shtick in between things as just the voiceover announcer for the horror movies on Friday night. And as it was developing along, I enjoyed the character that he was portraying as well and how he was kind of, positioning himself between the various segments of the movie.
Did he ever tell you how he developed the character?
He kind of was taking a tip from the famous Ernie Anderson, Goulardi, who was on opposite him on TV when he was working in Cleveland. But Goulardi was another sort of beatnik-type character. And Jerry decided to kind of update that and make it a sort of hippie ghoul. And so he kind of got the nod from that. And then he always said that his Svengoolie accent was kind of Bela Lugosi crossed with Yiddish.
That's a good way of putting it. Yeah.
Well, what was even funnier was he always described my accent as a combination of Bela Lugosi and Lawrence Welk.
So Berwyn really loves you.
I guess so, yeah. Much closer ties than I thought.
Well, it's interesting because looking back, because I asked the question I had earlier about the foundation for Jerry is because of the hippie persona, and then you mentioned the beatnik persona, it was interesting as a youngster with my local horror show host. I grew up in Michigan, and ours was Sir Graves Gasly out of Detroit. Is on the surface it was scary looking, but then I realized looking back, he did a segment in drag. He did a segment German. He would paint a face on his chin and be filmed upside down. And he'd show kids pictures. And in your case, looking at the early pictures, by the way, there's somebody here at work who grew up in Elkhart, and she wanted me to tell you, you scared her when she was a little kid.
Yeah, I've heard that from a few people.
You're
here
right.
And there.
but the fact is, maybe the exterior was scary, but you're cracking jokes the entire time. And I thought, especially with Jerry's, it's a hippie. He's not a vampire or a ghoul or a zombie. It's a hippie that delivers one-liners.
Right, exactly. I think part of it is just that the characters. I always said, there have always been people who said you should try to act more scary. And I've often said, well, the only people who will be scared by that are, kids under the age of 5. It's not very effective. If you're trying to act scary and, people are watching, they're going to go, oh, come on. Whereas making the character kind of comic relief to the horror is what seems to be what works. And for the most part, that's what most of the very successful hosts have done, whether it be tongue-in-cheek or, just blatant, goofballs like myself.
What did you think the first time you saw Count Floyd on SCTV?
I thought he was hilarious. It was funny because I had actually seen Joe Flaherty, who played Count Floyd, live at Second City while he was in his tenure here in Chicago. It was right after I got out of high school, in fact. And I thought he was a very funny guy to begin with. But then when I saw that, I thought it was really hilarious. And one of the things that somebody brought up is, you know, he obviously was still doing Second City here in town. He hadn't gone back up to Canada during the time that Jerry was doing his Svengoolie stuff here. So it seems like, you know, a little bit of that might have been, you know, added into his whole Count Floyd persona. The idea of, you know, running movies that maybe weren't quite, you know, what you would want to run during the time. Because Jerry had a few that were like, wait a minute, this isn't really a horror movie. And yeah, I thought Count Floyd was very, very funny.
Now, I know you started sending jokes to Jerry. What do you remember the first one he ever used?
I think it was something like, you'll love this one.
Okay.
What do you call a grave in Russia?
A what?
A communist plot.
Oh. You know what? I think that's being used on Fox News today, so it's all right.
Well, yes, it's right up their alley there. Yeah, so at first I was just sending him random jokes that I thought he could use because he was, you know, actually soliciting them from viewers. And then I, you know, let him know a little bit about what I was doing, that I was a broadcasting student, and I actually wrote something that was more specific for him. And he started to kind of request specific things, like, can you do a parody of such and such commercial or something like that? So it got into more long-form things than just separate jokes.
And how long before he invited you into the studio to work?
I would say it was, at the most, about a year, probably a little less than that. And he had me come in, and I ended up going in there, and he'd say, hey, can you do this voice for me off camera? And you know, I did some artwork that he needed for the show. One of the guys working there then would jokingly refer to me as Jerry's art director. And he had me going with him and doing his public appearances with him, his various characters and such. And, you know, and then it became pretty much he was trying to work it out so that I would have a full-time job at Channel 32. But before that happened, his Svengoolie show was canceled. So,
well, before the birth of Son, what did your parents hope you would be doing at this time?
You know, I don't know that they had any specific direction that they were hoping I would go in. My dad worked in sheet metal and ventilation, and I think he pretty much knew that I wasn't planning to go in that direction. They knew that I liked radio, and I think they kind of thought that I would go in that direction in broadcasting, but I don't know that they expected me to go into television as well.
Well, how did Son of Svengoolie come about?
Basically, what happened was there was a time in between when I became Son of Svengoolie and when Jerry stopped being Svengoolie that one of the guys that was a friend of Jerry's at one of the local stations had called him and said, you know, you should just do Svengoolie just as a summer fill-in thing for us here. And they talked about it a little bit, and Jerry was like, well, I don't know that I want to dress up in this stuff again. And he said, you know what? He said to me, why don't you could be like Son of Svengoolie, and then you and I can write and, you know, produce the thing together. And I was like, sure, that'd be cool. And then we talked about it, kicked around, had some false starts on it, and nothing ever really happened with it. And then a couple years down the road, when Jerry was going to head out to San Diego to do radio and TV there, he said, well, you know, what are you planning on doing now? Because somebody else I had been working with, Dick Orkin, do you know him?
I've
very
heard
famous,
the name.
Famous radio guy who did radio commercials and did a lot of famous modern radio serials like Chicken Man.
Oh, right.
And the Tooth Fairy.
Yeah.
I'd been working with him, and he went off to L.A., and now Jerry was leaving, and he said, well, you know, what are you going to do? And I said, well, maybe I'll try to pitch some local station on a TV show and see if I can make any inroads there. And he said, I tell you what, if you want to try to do the Son of Svengoolie thing, you have my blessing. And so he kind of handed that off to me, and which was very flattering that he would, you know, take the character that he had created and kind of, you know, turned it over to me, more or less.
Now, for those who don't go on YouTube, what was the, besides the look, what was the biggest difference between Jerry's character and yours?
Geez, let's see. Well, Jerry used to play the guitar and sing, and I cannot play the guitar well enough to do that.
We thank you for that.
Yes, yeah, anytime. Believe me, you wouldn't want to sit through that. But basically, it's the same type of character, you know, kind of mm-hmm. wisecracking. And I think Jerry's character, I don't know how to put this better, was a little more aggressive than mine. And I think that, you know, Sven is more, the one that I'm doing is more the Jack Benny character who's set upon by the other characters and such around him. Whereas Jerry was more, you know, the wise guy who was, you know, dealing with the others or something.
And, yeah, so you're the chicken butt of the jokes.
Yes, exactly. Well put.
Thank you. And when did the chickens your creation, the flying chickens?
Oh, no, that went back to Jerry.
Okay.
The famous old vaudeville prop of a rubber chicken.
Right.
He decided that whenever he would do some bad joke, which was pretty often, he would be pelted with those rather than tomatoes or something like that, or bricks, which would not have been pleasant.
Or the giant hook.
The giant hook, yes. That would have been much more difficult to have one of the stagehands maneuvering all the time. You got to also spread the fun to people, because if there's one thing people always request, it's, can I come and throw chickens at you?
Gee, I don't know what you're talking about. I think I'm at the bottom of the scroll right now.
I see.
My first viewing of you, of course, was syndicated on Channel 50 in Detroit, and this was in the early 80s. How did the syndication come about?
Well, after there had been various shows that had run back and forth, they had tried to run The Ghoul from one of the stations that was owned by, which company was it at the time? Kaiser, I guess, Kaiser Broadcasting. And they actually bumped Jerry Svengoolie off so that they could run The Ghoul. And he was not well accepted in Chicago because... compared to Jerry's character, this was, an interloper. And he didn't make any friends because we first started out saying, I'm like, yeah, we got rid of that bum Svengoolie. Nice work.
Nice.
But based on that and the fact that there was a guy in power at our Chicago station who was running all the field stations, they were field stations by then.
Right.
He really believed in what I was doing, and he wanted to get it on the other channels. And the funny thing was that we ended up on five different channels in different cities, but a lot of the stations, for some reason, felt that this was being forced on them, so they would not promote it, and they would do nothing to help us out. And now, years later, I hear from people who watched me in the various cities, and they were like, oh, yeah, everybody used to watch that. And I had no idea that there was an audience watching me back then. And they say, oh, you went to Chicago after this. And I said, no, actually, I was in Chicago the whole time. And we would customize the opens and closes, especially, so that it would look like, it was something, with jokes playing off that specific city. It was kind of a pain because we'd have to reshoot every open and every close for each city, mm-hmm. and I'd have to rewrite it so that I would get in local jokes.
What were the other cities?
We were in San Francisco, Boston, Philadelphia, Detroit, and Chicago.
I remember because you made a crack on Bill Kennedy, who hosted the local show, show in the afternoon. And I remember calling Channel 50 and asking about you, and they told me that you were based out of Chicago, and I didn't believe them.
No,
because you mentioned Bill Kennedy. How did you know? Of course you know. So,
yeah. Well, it was funny because when we were going to do it, I asked each one of the stations, can you just send me a bunch of people, like a weatherman that I can make fun of, various locations in the city, sports teams. And out of the stations, a couple of them sent really detailed stuff, and the rest were like, yeah, never mind.
Okay, I have to ask, how was Detroit's treatment of you?
Detroit was fairly weak. Sorry. They sent like just a little bit of information and a Detroit Pistons basketball jersey.
You still have it?
I believe I gave it to one of my brothers after the show was over.
How long did this last, the syndication?
It varied in the cities from like about 6 months to a year.
Okay.
And a lot of that was because they just, they didn't promote it, and they felt like it was not, it was not something they wanted to do. It wasn't their production. At one point, we actually went to Philadelphia and shot on their set. They built a whole set just for me to shoot on.
Wow.
And everybody there, for the most part, was not cooperative. We were doing different bits and stuff. We ran a bit that was pretty famous that we did, Mr. Robber's Neighborhood.
Right.
Where, I'm supposed to be like a Fred Rogers as a criminal who breaks into people's homes. That's why he changes his shoes so they can't hear him.
Right.
And he was talking about how he had a good sharp knife to do something with. And one of the engineers there goes, oh, that's nice, teaching kids to use knives.
Wow, this coming from Philly fans that cheer when Santa Claus get taken off on a stretcher at Eagles games.
Well, what can I tell you? So it was an uphill battle in most of those places, and I think that's why it didn't last, in especially in a couple of those cities.
Well, from a kid's standpoint, it felt like it was on longer, and I mean that as a compliment. And I think also because of the test of time, and there's no internet, and it was, you had to be there for that time, unless you had a VHS or Betamax, you had to be there for that time to see the show.
Exactly. Yeah, that was it. You know, that's why I hear these people now who see the old clips and they go, "Wait, I remember when this was on in you know, San Francisco or whatever."
Yep.
It's quite a story. I think San Francisco was the city that we were in the longest, and that was like a full year. By then, all the others had dropped out.
Some of the other characters that you had now, was Durwood from the Jerry era, or was and you inherited him?
Yes, Durwood, the ventriloquist puppet, was from Jerry's era, and to this day, I wish he hadn't picked such a high falsetto voice, which he could do much better than I could, because I felt he should still have a similar type voice. You know, I didn't want to change the voice on it, but it's much harder for me to do. Tombstone was a character based on, really, he had a female skull named Zelda. And, again, I didn't want to do the exact same thing with that, so we created Tombstone. His name originally was Zalman T. Tombstone, Jr., and it was a playoff on the old Billy Saluga character, Raymond J. Johnson, Jr., that was very popular
right.
at that time.
Yeah, yeah.
And Tombstone even had his own little litany, you know, like that, you doesn't have to call me Johnson type thing, you know. But you can call me Toomey, or you could call me, and we did that at a wild beginning. After all, I was like, I think people will be sick of this. Let's just drop it.
I always imagined Tombstone, it sounded like if Bob Dylan and the Kingfish had a child.
Yeah, that's pretty close. I'd
okay.
say, definitely.
Tell us about the evolution of Kerwin.
Kerwin, yeah. Well, we've had a series of different sort of puppet-like assistants doing the mail. The first was our piano player, Doug.
Right.
And he was actually a live person. But he often couldn't stay around long enough because he's in actuality a working musician who constantly has different gigs all over the place. So he couldn't wait around until we got, you know, after we did the song to do the music. We did the music bits, and then we'd have to wait to do the mail after we did several other things, and he often couldn't stay around. So we'd say, well, let's try some things. And we had a bat whose voice was like a sort of processed high tone thing.
Right.
And it was so annoying that one of the bosses in charge here actually said, I want you to get rid of it. And we had to actually do a bit where he was fired because he couldn't stand that voice. And then for a while we had a pterodactyl who was a disc jockey who was the assistant, and a dinosaur, I believe. We're very into reptiles at times.
I see.
And finally, we had a spider for a while, and because he had eight legs, he had eight different voices, and for some reason that just didn't work at all. But finally, someone from our kids' show, Green Screen Adventures, a young lady named Jessica Hope Carlton, who is very adept at building puppets, kind of as a surprise, cooperating with my director, came up with this. She used like one of those sort of alligator type things you buy at the zoo. It's like a head on a stick and you pull the little trigger to make it talk and move the mouth. And she combined that with the body of a rubber chicken and created Kerwin as a prehistoric rubber chicken.
Who sounds like Jerry Lewis.
Who, yeah, well, when I first looked at him, when they gave him to me, he had these kind of goofy eyes and funny teeth. And for some reason, it struck me that he sort of looked like very young Jerry Lewis. So that was why he got the voice. It was kind of like this.
Do you also not bring up Dean Martin around him?
No, I constantly bring up Dean Martin just to make him angry.
So speaking of Doug, how do you select the music for the shows?
You know, I've often been asked by one of my coworkers, what are you thinking? Because I'll say, you know, I want to do something, you know, this is like flying to the moon. And he'll say, okay, and he comes up with all these songs with moon in it, and then I'll go, I know, and come up with some song that has no word moon in it, and he'll be like, wait, I don't get it, but there's some way that I can tie in certain lyrics that sound exactly like, you know, what the originals are that has something to do with the movie.
And how did you meet Doug?
Doug and I went to high school together, actually. We were in band together in high school. And we became friends and just hung around together. And when I started doing TV shows, I figured, you know, it would be great to have him help out.
What did you play?
I played trombone. It's been a long time since I played trombone, so please don't ask me to do a solo.
Oh, no, that's well, we live in the land of J.J. Johnson. We wouldn't ask you to do that.
Well, but, certainly, yeah.
But I also imagined you as Woody Allen in Take the Money and Run, where you played the cello, but you also had to drag the chair during the parade.
Let me tell you, being a trombone player in a parade is not fun because you're right at the front of the band, because of the slide action, they put you there, and also, when you're playing, you don't get to look down and see if there's anything dropped by the horses that were earlier in the parade. That was one of the biggest hazards. And I always thought that doing marching band out on a field was one of the most unmusical experiences ever, because you think you're doing these formations and stuff, and half the instruments turn away from the stands while they're walking in, you know, some pattern, and that means they can't hear that part of the music. So it's like you're not hearing the whole, you know, thing like you do in a concert. What's the deal?
How did Jerry and you come up with all of those sound clips?
Well, with Jerry, it was a matter of, you know, he used them in his radio stuff. Mm-hmm. And he had a huge library of sound effects and little sound bites and things that he passed a lot of on to me. And actually, it was the same thing with me because I wanted to be in radio, and I also did that. I mean, maybe it's not as common anymore, but a lot of disc jockeys used to use little, you know,
sure,
these little sound bites, little, you know, cart type reactions, and called, because they were on audio carts that you'd throw into the machine. And just built up this whole library. And of course, once I started here, a lot of the guys had suggestions for things or would find something in a show or in a commercial and say, oh, you know, you should really use this. So we've got it all. It's all now computerized, obviously, like everything else. It's all digital, and it's in a little machine that we could just call up a number and hit.
How many films or how many episodes do you record in one batch?
It varies. We've done as many as 9.
Wow.
Which is, you know, we're in the studio from noon until 9 o'clock every night when we do these.
Okay.
And that's a long haul. Believe me, being in that makeup for that length of time, not pleasant. But, yeah, we've done as many as 9, and a comfortable range is usually 5, I would say.
Okay.
Because that gives us a little, you know, easier time of it. And we're not, like, under the gun like, you know, Lucy in the Candy Factory.
And when you're selecting the films, is there a pattern? I mean, you know, sci-fi, horror, monster movie, killer movie. Is there a pattern of any kind?
Well, it's not so much a pattern. My idea usually is to try to vary it somewhat, because we do get people who will often complain about the fact that we're doing you know, too many mummy movies all at once or too many Frankenstein movies. And, you know, to me it's like you're complaining about these Universal classics. Okay, whatever. But I try to vary them when I can. And also, there are certain ones that we have only a certain time window for, so we have to make sure that they can air only during, like, we've had movies that we can only run during 1 month.
Jeez.
So we have to, you know, make sure it gets in then. So a lot of times it depends on what the contractual window is, the window of time that we can fit the movies in, and, you know, what's available to us at what times.
Right off the top of your head, what are some of your favorite and least favorite films that you've shown over the years?
No, favorite ones, definitely Bride of Frankenstein. I do like House of Frankenstein. I got to run Nightmare on Elm Street, which I really enjoyed,
wow,
and Halloween, the originals. I really enjoyed those. Ones that I don't like as well, there's quite a few of those. I think I may have mentioned to you before the Midnight Movie Massacre, which was an absolutely terrible movie. There was one movie that I often cannot remember, Track of the Vampire,
oh,
which is so bad and boring. It's a movie where half of it was shot in California and the other half was shot in Yugoslavia, and neither side knew what the other side was doing. And it was so bad that when I was at Channel 32, we actually intercut it with a bunch of other things. And we did one whole segment that was kind of, you know, Svens around, where it had changed, and suddenly the woman, it's a scene where this woman is being chased all through the city and into the ocean by the vampire.
Mm-hmm.
And with my redubbing, it became the fact that she was supposed to show up for swim team practice and didn't want to. And that was the coach running after her. And at times there was like a bald lifeguard who showed up. So naturally his voice became that of Curly Howard from the Three Stooges.
Of course.
So, yeah, that was one of the really, really awful ones.
I'm saying, does is it the quality of the film that gets it a Spencer Brown treatment, or have you? I think I remember once you did it with even with Night of the Living Dead.
We did separate scenes from that. A lot of times I'll lift scenes, and so it doesn't interrupt the flow of the movie or, you know, ruin people's enjoyment of the actual movie itself. If it's a really bad movie, a lot of times the only way to save it is to do something like add some sound effects to it along the way.
Now, I know there was one of the writers from Mystery Science Theater 3000 grew up in Chicago. Have you made contact with any of those guys before?
No, I've never been in contact with them. I've heard from other people that, you know, they've done little shout-outs to Sven in some of their shows. That one guy said he went to some convention and dressed as me and ran into one of them, and the guy immediately said, "Hey, your son is Sven Gulli."
Okay.
they know about it. And I remember reading an article in the Chicago Tribune where they were talking to a couple of the guys, and they said, you know, we weren't the type of guys who were trying to, you know, pick up Cousin Brucey on the radio from New York or whatever like that. We were trying to watch people like Ray Rayner, who did a morning kids show here in Chicago, and Sven Gulli. So they were aware of both, and they obviously saw both Jerry Sven Gulli and my son of Sven Gulli.
Have you ever talked to any of the filmmakers or actors whose movies you've aired?
Very rarely. You know, a lot of them right now, a lot of these Universal folks,
a lot of them
not
are
around.
Dead.
although I did hear, I've got a couple guys who do a great website called Terror from Beyond the Daves. And they have a blog about different horror hosts and horror-oriented things. And they both are guys who grew up watching me and are big fans. And now, especially with our national exposure, when they go to conventions, they get a lot of feedback about the show from people. They ran into Julie Adams, who was the beautiful woman in the white bathing suit in Creature from the Black Lagoon.
Yes.
And she was just thrilled to hear that, you know, we show her movie on our program. The same thing with Tippi Hedren from The Birds.
Sure.
We ran at The Birds here in Chicago and won the time slot, which was just, you know, incredible. It's like Sven Gulli winning the time slot. Good grief. But she was another one who was just thrilled to hear that we were running that show on free broadcast TV, since it hasn't appeared on that very much. And it's just really great to, you know, get even these secondhand things. I did meet Robert Englund, Freddy Krueger. And it turns out he's a big fan of my show. He's been watching it out in California now, and he's had a lot of very complimentary things to say about it, which is really nice. Lance Henriksen,
mm-hmm.
Met up with him. He's a very nice guy. It was a lot of fun and seemed to enjoy the show. We ran him in Pumpkinhead a couple
yes.
times.
Mm-hmm.
And I think Piranha 2 as well. So.
Well, that's good.
Yes.
How often are you allowed in Berwyn?
I'm allowed there any darn time I want to be there.
Do you have the key to the city yet?
They don't even need a key. I've got like a key card. Just lets me in and out. It's not a problem. Actually, yeah, it's funny because just about, I'd say, 95% of the people in Berwyn love that we do the stuff that we do about that city. And they know it's just jokes. For a while, they had a mayor who was, you know, we don't want to be the butt of Sven Gulli's jokes. And yet any time I'd show up there, he always made sure he was there to get a picture shaking my hand.
Politician.
Yes. And occasionally it's like the people who are like, you shouldn't make fun of our town. But the thing is, every time I've done a radio interview or TV interview and people have asked about Berwyn, I've always, you know, stated what I just told you and the fact that it's a really nice suburb. The people are very nice there. They're all hardworking people, and now they're trying to be, you know, a little more upscale, and they're adding more arts and things, and, you know, God bless them. It's a nice place, and it also has my favorite horror collectibles store, a place called Horror Vault, which has a real nice stock of all sorts of things.
How did you pick Berwyn out of all the towns for the bit?
That was Jerry's doing. Back when he was trying to figure it out, he had always had, when he was in Cleveland, Goulardi, Ernie Anderson, made fun of a suburb called Parma. And when he came here, he had that in mind. And he also, at that time, Rona Martin's Laugh-In was kind of winding down.
Uh-huh.
And they were making fun of beautiful downtown Burbank, as was Johnny Carson. And he thought, well, we need to do something like that. We can make small town jokes about that. It'd be funny. And he was trying to decide on something. And he ended up having a sponsor that was from the Berwyn area. And when he went there, it seemed like the one street, Ogden Avenue, was all savings and loans and used car lots. And then he found out that they had the yearly parade in honor of mushrooms, the Hobie Parade. Hobie is Czech for mushroom.
Yeah.
And he decided this would be a good place to use as our city that we kind of poke fun at.
Well, it has a flow to it compared to, say, Downers Grove, Westmont, or Wheaton.
Yeah, you can't go like Cicero. It doesn't flow as well as Berwyn.
Is there a film that you've always wanted to show and have not had a chance to do yet?
Yes, Fiend Without a Face. Do you know that movie?
The French film, right?
No.
Oh
no,
I'm thinking of Eyes Without a Face. I'm sorry.
No. This is like a cheapo. I think it's an American International one.
Okay.
Where there's something invisible that is killing people, and they're not sure what it is. And at some point, they find a way to make them visible, and it turns out there are these brains with spinal columns that kind of like inch along. They were done with stop motion animation. And when they are fighting with them, when you shoot one, it makes a noise like a whoopee cushion, kind of, and lets loose the sort of raspberry jelly type stuff.
Is this the flying brains with the eyes? Or am I thinking of something else?
You may be confusing it with the brain from Planet Eros.
Ah, okay. All right.
But these, you would remember these right away because they're smaller brains, about the size of a human brain, but they have this sort of spinal column, and they inch along like an inchworm using that. And they can also, like, leap through the air.
Well, this is my YouTube project for the day. That's good.
All right. Yes, you'll enjoy it. Believe me.
Now, how long have you been with the U?
I have been here since 1995. At WCIU, and then as we've added more stations, my shows have gone on to the various stations, and including now our network, MeTV.
How did the MeTV deal come about?
Because of the great success we had here in town. When the U first went on, it was kind of a hybrid of what MeTV is, and also a little more modern type programming that we would manage to get. And as we went along, my boss, Neil Saban, who was like a genius, had noticed that like Nick at Night and TV Land were changing dramatically, and they weren't what they originally were supposed to be, you know, with this classic TV stuff. And he had this idea of making the MeTV station, which we did first locally here, and he felt that there was viability to that across the country since, you know, people weren't really getting that presented the way that we presented, and he managed to start the wheels in motion, and now we're in almost 80% of the country.
Cool.
And it's especially amazing that it happened in about a year's time. To have that kind of progress really says a lot for what Neil could do and what the MeTV national network can do.
I'd say you could call those other syndicated cities from the 80s and blow raspberries at them, but they're probably not there anymore or probably dead.
Oh, you never know. Yeah, most of the people involved have probably moved on and are not quite around anymore or have been deposed. Knowing the nature of television, they probably lost their jobs. And
they're mad as hell and they're not going to take it anymore.
Yes, and I'll shed a tear for them like that Indian standing alongside the highway.
For MeTV, is it strictly Universal Films?
Right now it is, yeah. We have a really nice contract with Universal, and we're actually working on an extension of that for the future that would add in even more films for us. And we're hoping that that'll happen. And this is really, you know, the first broadcast TV national exposure for these Universal horror films since many, many years ago.
Which I think is a really cool thing. I know recently there's been films like The Mole People, which I haven't seen in a long, long time. And I know the horror film with Dirk Benedict and Strother Martin. I mean, those are ones I can't even think of the last time
I saw
those.
You're talking about the...
But I think it's cool that you look for films that have not seen the light of day in a long time.
Yeah, and I think it's really an education for a lot of people because there is a generation that hasn't seen these. When we were kids, it seemed like they ran them much more on television. And now, if they run at all, they run on cable as opposed to on, you know, actual broadcast TV. So the fact that we're kind of, you know, reintroducing these to a lot of people who maybe never saw them before is really great. And it's nice to continue the Universal legacy.
And also, you talk about from an educational standpoint, I love when you do a segment based on who these actors appeared in, you know, what other films they've appeared in, what the director has worked on. You know, when my daughter saw that Bela Lugosi played the Frankenstein monster, that blew her lid a little bit in a good way.
Sure, yeah. There are things that people really don't expect or, you know, they don't know about connections to various things. Like the people who ended up playing some other part on a TV series years later, that they had no idea that ever happened. So it's very cool to be able to, you know, make these connections for people or just remind people, you know, this guy also did this. And at times it's really a tribute to the versatility of the actors, and it's great to show that they had a wide enough range to do so many things.
You're walking IMDb, sir.
Yeah. No, I'm sitting right now, actually.
And I know also you've also been showing comedy shows, and don't listen to the internet. There's nothing wrong with that. With showing, you know, I know you've done the Three Stooges marathon and Abbott and Costello, and
yeah,
you know.
Well, most of the Abbott and Costello stuff we've shown still has a horror element to it. It's not, you know, we're not just showing, you know, Hit the Ice or something like that.
Right.
Abbott and Costello Meet the Mummy or you know, Frankenstein or whoever. We've thrown in a few things here and there. Yeah, well, you know, Ghost and Mr. Chicken, there's still like a horror scare element to that. If anything, you know, we've run some Marx Brothers movies, and that's mainly because I'm a big fan of the Marx Brothers. They were a big influence on me. And, you know, I love when people are like, oh, this is wrong. You should be showing only scary things. And it's like, have you noticed that a great portion of my part of the show is comedy?
Yeah.
I don't know.
And we also like that, you know, you air it the same reason why dogs lick their elbows, because you can.
There you go. Exactly.
And also,
thanks for saying elbows.
Well, yes. Thank you for saying elbows, too. And also, it's really cool that the show on MeTV, you kind of become an ambassador for local horror show hosts. It's a lost art. I mean, we have Sammy Terry popping up every few months here in Indianapolis, but it's cool for you to give shout outs to cities that have had hosts, and you show other hosts, and even show old photos of Jerry and you. It's a lost art, I think, for local television.
Well, with the way that television has been going now in the TV economy, most local stations do not do entertainment-type shows. They're mainly, you know, if they have budgets, they're going to do news and sports and public affairs and an occasional magazine show. But, you know, they're not going to do something that's strictly entertainment because, according to them, it doesn't generate enough money to justify, you know, the studio time and editing time and everything like that. And when we first started here locally, the people in charge of the station said, you know, well, maybe we're not going to make money on this, but it's an important part of TV and something that viewers really get an attachment to and make a connection with, and that's important to us. Mm-hmm. And now, of course, you know, we're doing very well, and it's nice to see that people, you know, every email I get from out of town, for the most part, will mention, we haven't had anything in town like this since, you know, in the 70s with, you know, Dr. Bad Teeth or something like that. So there's always, everybody's got a horror host they watch sometime in their life, it seems.
Do you do shows strictly for MeTV, and then you do shows strictly for the U?
We have some shows that run basically, well, the ones that run on MeTV right now also run on the U as like a week delay basis. But then on the U2, we run some of the older ones that we have that we still have rights to or that are public domain. And I also do a Three Stooges show, Stoogiepalooza, that runs on Saturday nights on our Me2 channel.
So I was going to say, how often do you get to appear on TV as Rich?
Every week.
Okay.
Basically, yeah.
There you go.
So, yeah, I'm in the makeup, I'm out of the makeup. In the makeup, out of the makeup.
Well, you know, it keeps you young, maybe.
Well, I don't know about that.
Or young at heart.
Okay, I'll go with that.
So what's next for Svengoolie?
Right now, it seems like we're just continuing to go to more and more of the places in America. More and more stations are picking up the MeTV network and getting better distribution of it. And a lot of them, we started out just over the air, and now it's going to cable as well in a lot of the cities, and wider distribution in a lot of the cities. There are a lot of rumors about out on the West Coast that we're going to have more visibility out there. So I think it's just a matter of the spin show catching on in these various places, and then I think the next step after that is possibly starting to make public appearances all over the country, which should be fun.
Well, you know, you have a place to crash in Indianapolis, that's for sure.
Well, thanks, I appreciate that.
Go see a good movie. You deserve it. Have a great holiday weekend, everybody. You're listening to the Film Sociology of Film Talk Show here on WFYI HD2 The Point and WFYI.org.
We gone. Good night, Fort Myers. Good night, California.
Happy Labor Day.